funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Think about the relationship between where you are and, where you come from and who you are, and imagine how it might be different if you were from a place with a long and ongoing history of disagreement over who really belongs. An exhibition at the Pollock Gallery on the SMU campus through September 26th has brought together works by Palestinian video artists from Israel who use the medium to look at the frustrations and the contradictions of their hybrid identities as Palestinians with Israeli citizenship. Joining us to talk about this are the exhibition's curator, Noah Simblist, who is associate professor and chair of the Division of Art at the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU, and Aissa Deeby is an artist whose 2013 The Trial is featured in the show, which is called Where Are You From? And also includes works by Dor Guez and Kamal Al-Jafari. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Noah, how did you develop an interest in this subject as being such a rich area to build an exhibition around?
Well, this subject's been the subject of my research for a long time now. Since about 2006, I've been visiting Israel. I grew up going there many, many times, and I've been writing short pieces, curating exhibitions. And it's also the topic of a dissertation I'm working on of art and politics in Israel-Palestine since 2000. And it's something that I think often gets overlooked, the position of what's sometimes called as 1948 Palestinians or Palestinian Israelis or Israeli Arabs. Each of these terms has a very loaded politics behind them. And especially even just this summer with the events in Gaza, you often see in media this binary of either Israeli or Palestinian, whereas there's a lot in between. And I wanted to reveal that not just through writing or through a kind of dogmatic teaching perspective, but just through artworks that are exploring the daily life of that position in all its complexities.
Aissa, can you talk about who decides your identity if you are a Palestinian living in Israel? Do you decide it for yourself, or does the broader culture decide?
Well, of course I decide it for myself, but you're born into a situation where been forced on you. So I think growing up in Haifa, the term of being Palestinian in Israel is quite complicated. And this term, Palestinians who remain in this piece of land that became Israel, for many, many, many years, their Palestinian identity was hidden. And they will whisper it, say, I'm a Palestinian. But then when they meet an Israeli guy, said, I'm an Israeli Arab. So that this like a complicated relationship because of the history of the conflict. So people were really terrified to declare their identity until I think 1993, post-Oslo, they felt more comfortable to start talking about who they are, you know. But before 1993, it was quite difficult to make it such a declaration.
And those identities are complicated not only domestically, but I would imagine also with friends and relatives and other people who are part of the diaspora.
Yeah, it's complicated, but I think today, in those days and today's politics and people awareness, it's much easier to communicate identities. I think 10, 15 years ago was much more complex. I think 20 years ago, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Noah, how did you begin thinking about who you wanted in this show, what works you definitely wanted to include?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it came out of a long time of sort of traveling and meeting a number of people and seeing exhibitions. So, for instance, Aissa and I met in Austin. We have a mutual friend and colleague, Tarek El-Aris, who's a part of the faculty in the Middle Eastern Studies Department at UT Austin. And he had given a talk about his work in the summer. They have an Arabic flagship program that teaches sort of intensive Arabic language to students. So I first met him through that. At the time, Aissa was teaching in Cairo, and since then is now in New York. And then Dor Guez, I met a number of years ago in Tel Aviv. He was up for a prize at the Tel Aviv Art Museum, and since then I've met him in Jaffa, where he lives. And then Kamal Al-Jafari, I met in Ramallah at the Sakakini Cultural Center, where he was giving a screening of the film that we're showing in the Pollock Gallery now. So often it's sort of coming across these people and then trying to sort of assimilate these commonalities. And because I was looking for this one particular position, you know, I think these are all three incredibly strong artists who also work in video, who have some aspect of their personal life that's a part of it, but the personal is not the ultimate subject of the work. The personal is one part of a much larger set of issues, not just in terms of Israel-Palestine, but in terms of nationalism in general.
Are there things, you said, that you fully understood about yourself and where you had come from after you moved away?
Yeah, I think my migration, I left many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think my migration have affected my position. It made it probably more clearer. You know, I had the time to think about my belonging and my identity since... I think more than 20 something years I've been living between the States and England, and this is where I went to school. I think issues of identity, when you leave your place of origin, they become more urgent, but probably they are much easier to be fixed. It took me 6 years to write my PhD to figure it out and to think this was a necessary thing to do to be able to understand this complexity of belonging. Today, I don't think I have any issues with belonging. I know who I am, where I live, and I know how to position myself. But being a person with all this complex identities, you know, it's not an easy starting point.
How did you begin to navigate that when you were a child? And at what point did you realize the complexity of your identity as compared with maybe classmates or neighbors for whom it was simpler?
I think in the school. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to Catholic school. And to say Palestine in the Catholic school at that days in the 1980s was a crime. So we knew we were Christians and we are in Catholic school. And then when the political events starting to evolve, we start developing awareness. You know, at home, you know, I had lots of political conversations with my father. He passed away now. But he was the one who's politically aware, and he was telling us, you know, all the stories of the 1948 war and what he experienced. But in the public sphere, people were keeping all those stories for themselves. So they were very intimate experiences because the 1948 trauma, it carried on with a generation who experienced it. So they wanted, some of them, they wanted their sons and daughters to have probably a fresh start, or just to help them to have a different life. But then the reality outside all the time reminded everybody that this is not the case.
So there's no denying what happened.
No,
and there's no, you can't really protect
from that. Of course not, of course not. But I think, you know, being born to the generation that lived through the 1948 Nakba, we call it, catastrophe, they did hide a lot of stories from us as young second generation or third generation Palestinians after the Nakba. So they will give us a different perspective on life. Or I think it's a post-traumatic experience. They didn't want to share it with us. So we had to learn about it from our own perspectives, our own sources. But not fully from our parents. Hmm.
What was it like for you, Noah, learning these stories as an American, kind of coming to this from a different culture?
Well, I mean, I actually grew up in a very Jewish Zionist community in New York, and before that in Europe. So I had known a lot of these stories, but from one very particular perspective. But I started re-educating myself starting around college. And it was one trip in 2006 that was like very transformational in a lot of ways, where I actually met with a lot of NGOs, some of whom are Israeli-run, some Palestinian-run. And there was one actually called Zochrot, which is an Israeli-run organization. Zochrot means to remember, the remembrance, and it's really remembrance of the Nakba, of the catastrophe that Aissa was just talking about. And I interviewed two people. One was the founder, Eitan Bronstein, who grew up as a kibbutznik, someone from a very Zionist background in a kibbutz in the north of Israel, who had discovered this for himself. And then the other was a woman who was from Haifa, who was Palestinian-Israeli, who was going through this process post-Second Intifada, like Second Intifada in 2000, who had told me the similar stories of growing up being ashamed of her father, not wanting to think of Palestinian as a national identity or the Palestinian flag or any references to the past. And that, it just changed so much for me in my thinking, and I've really been dedicating a lot to not only to learn more about the situation as it is in a wider perspective from which I was taught, but also to help other people to see it, and to not just see it and to sort of change ideologically, but to experience it in a very tangible way, something that doesn't have easy answers.
The easy answers issue is really interesting to me because there are so many things we discuss and we sort of understand that intelligent people can disagree and that there are lots of ways of looking at something. On a question like this, with issues like this, it seems that everyone is expecting you to choose a side and stick with it and find really identification with only one side. How does that complicate or maybe enrich making art about these questions?
Well, I think the most complicated aspect of the life in Palestine and Israel is that there's two set of nations. They're writing poetry about the same place. They're writing novels about the same place. They created two different but very similar narratives of the same place. If you look at Darwish and Amichai, the national poet of Israel, and Darwish, the national poet of Palestine, they write poetry about the Sea of Haifa the same. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's two narratives that were established in historical Palestine for two different groups, but very similar groups. Taking sides, you know, it's like you don't choose to take side, you're born into it, you know? And then you change your position. You know, you take a position when you're really aware and understand what's going on around you. But the sides are really defined first genetically. You know, you're born as a Palestinian. Whatever you do, you're not going to be different. And you're born as an Israeli Jew, and then what you do with it, that's a question. And, you know, how you change your position, how do you try to understand the other narrative, and you see you position yourself in relationship to it. And I think that's a question. And because there's two dilemmas, you know, the Jewish community in historical Palestine or Israel or 1948, you know, all those terms, they're coming from a very diverse global community. You know, you see Arab Jewish people are coming from Yemen and from Libya and from Iraq and from Egypt and from Syria and from Lebanon. And for generations and generations, the majority of Ashkenazi society totally marginalized their background and their culture and their names and their language because they were linked to what is framed as the enemy culture and the enemy narrative, yeah? And those people were totally lost within their own society and their own belonging. And for me, somebody who's born into a Palestinian culture and Palestinian family, you know, those to be marginalized in the place where you're born, it's your homeland, but it's not your country. I think I could understand it by default. It's a reality that, you know, it happened to me. But for other people who are coming to the place that was supposed to be a safe haven for them and then to be discriminating against and be a second-class citizen or third-class citizen, it's a different narrative. I think it all goes back to awareness and how people build their awareness of their surrounding and how they really understand where they live in and then who they are, where they come from, become a question.
We'll talk more about this in just a moment with artist Aissa Deeby. His film, The Trial, is prominently featured in a show taking place now, an exhibition at the Pollock Gallery on the SMU campus through September 26th. We also have the curator of that exhibition, Noah Simblist, with us. He's associate professor and chair in the Division of Art at the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There's an exhibition on display at the Pollock Gallery on the SMU campus through September 26th called Where Are You From? We're speaking this hour with artist Aissa Deeby, whose film The Trial is featured in the show, and we are speaking with its curator, Noah Simblist, who's also associate professor and chair of the Division of Art at the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or email think@kera.org. So, Aissa, your film, The Trial, is a sort of recreation of a testimony, deposition testimony, given by a Palestinian Israeli poet and scholar named Daoud Turki. Am I saying that right, Turki?
That's right, yeah.
For those unfamiliar with him, talk a little bit about his influence and what put him on trial.
Sorry. Okay, Daoud Turki was a traditional Palestinian communist from the northern of Galilee, and he grew up in Haifa.
Your hometown?
In my hometown. He was my parents' neighbor, but I discovered it after I became 18 years old. I never really knew nothing about him. He was a poet, and in the 1960s, he established a group that was with the context of the whole European movement of small leftist revolutionary groups. He called it the Red Front, and this group was established by both Israeli Jewish citizens and Palestinian citizens of Israel to create a revolutionary group to start a military revolution, a military socialist revolution from Haifa all the way to Syria and Jordan and Lebanon, to create this greater Syria where everybody will live under socialism and they will solve the national conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians.
So sort of dissolve nationalist identities, yeah, in service to this
into socialism,
communal kind of living.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What happened in the end, the whole group was put in jail because they went to Syria to train in the military camps with the Palestinian movement. And then they put in trial. This was like one of the most famous trials in the history of Israel-Palestine, where Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs together in the same trial being blamed for betraying the state of Israel by aligning with the enemy and creating a military movement. You know, Daoud Turki, I think, and Udi Adiv, the Jewish guy and the group leader, they were accused to being doing some spy. You know, they were accused to be like spies or working in the service of a foreign enemy, mm-hmm. You know. And this group, you know, generally, if you want to think about it, it's a small utopian group that they really took everything to the extreme with this fantasy of the 1970s socialist utopia, and they believed that they could manage 35 of them, you know, to change the whole world. They ended up, all of them, in jail for many, many years, and they were released in the late 80s for two different reasons. Daoud Turki was released from jail by an exchange, prisoner exchange deal between Israel and one of the Palestinian organizations. And Udi was released by the president of the state of Israel. Daoud died a few years ago, and Udi left Israel to England, obtained his PhD in political science, and came back, became a professor in political science, teaching in the Open University, so he's teaching online. Daoud has a very small influence on a very small group, and everybody looked at him, you know, when he left jail and came out, and everybody, you know, then his story became more popular, and people start really to know him and read his poetry in the local newspapers. Became this almost post-absurd dreamer who believed in those, you know, out-of-date, out-of-fashion ideas that people would not really put in perspective in today's life. But they had a lot of respect for him that he went all the way and he wanted to take his ideas into practice. But then the price was was an awful one. He spent 17 or 15 years in the jail. What was quite fascinating for me in this story is that I found his speech that he gave in the courtroom. And his speech was a statement about everything to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his position from the international imperialism and colonialism. And it felt like 35 people in 1970, 69, 70, 71, 73, this one was the trial, taking this big, full responsibility to change this world that they are living in. It's the impossible of the impossible of the impossible of the impossible. And I think looking at this time in Israel-Palestine, what really interests me in it is that in some point, the conflict or the struggle for liberation or peace or justice in Palestine, in that moment became a post-national. And then when the Jews and the Arabs felt that probably there's another utopian solution where we give up our national belonging and align together to build this utopian world, you know. And if I was a fiction filmmaker, probably my question will be what happened after. If they succeeded, they didn't succeed, let's make a fiction movie. But as an artist, I wanted to take this critical moment in history because I'm interested in archival materials and resistance and poetry and text and give it another dimension. And I think what makes it fascinating is this utopian moment in the history of Israel-Palestine. With totally understanding that the work, the motivation of the work is purely intellectual and artistic. It's not like I'm doing the work because of sympathy. I produce the work because I'm really interested in this subject matter. I think it's a fascinating to look at the concept of utopia by highlighting time and place that is close to me and see what happened at that time. You know, 1969, when they're starting to establish the group, this was the year when I was born. So this is like almost an old autobiographical piece. And many years ago, one of the people who wrote about my work, they blame me that all the time I go back home to find the narratives for my pieces. And I think most likely my work all the time is going back home and finding those stories. And it happened, Turkey was my neighbor, you know.
So you underscore the fact that this, in some ways, couldn't happen based on the conditions that existed there and continue to exist by having the actors who are reading the text of this speech mm-hmm. constantly interrupted. Can you talk about what you noticed the first time you saw the film, Noah?
Yeah, the first time Issa and I were in contact leading up. So this film premiered at the Venice Biennale as a part of the Palestinian Pavilion. Just a quick note about that is that, you know, the Venice Biennale is this huge international exhibition. It happens every 2 years in Venice. It's the oldest one of the biennials. And it's established on based on a national paradigm. There are these pavilions with a particular nation that then represents itself through these artists. Palestine is not really a recognized state by most countries. And so for the past few iterations of the Venice Biennale, there have been Palestinian pavilions, but they are unofficial. They're not within the official grounds of the Venice Biennale. So that in and of itself is a kind of context that I was thinking about as I was seeing this piece and talking to Issa about it. So he was working on it and sent me a rough cut of it. And I was incredibly struck, first of all, with the way that he was addressing the concept of the what is now the show, but something that I hadn't seen very much with a lot of artists dealing with Israel-Palestine, was thinking about this kind of this revolutionary period, a global revolutionary period in the late 60s, early 70s, but one that that was cutting across nationalism I was thinking of in terms of verticals through the horizontal of class, mm. right? And that in and of itself is a very utopian idea. In the film, it's basically filmed in a black box. There are these two actors that are wearing red T-shirts, red itself, like a kind of revolutionary socialist color. And the in white letters, it says revolutionary on the T-shirts themselves. And yet, like as they're sort of reading this text, as Aisa said, of the speech that Daoud Turki gave at his trial, something that has the sort of traditional 60s, 70s height of rhetoric, right? It's sort of it's a slow rumble that gets like louder and louder and louder, both in terms of its aspirations and its critique, but also in terms of its actual volume. But each time he's trying to get towards that kind of revolutionary arc, he's completely interrupted by, would you like a cup of coffee? Would you like a glass of water? And you hear the water and the coffee sort of like being moved across the table and clunk on the table. And it reminded me that I participated in this building camp that the Israeli Committee of Housing Against Housing Demolitions runs as a research for another piece by an Israeli artist, Yael Bartana. And basically, it's a camp of rebuilding houses that are Palestinian houses that are destroyed by the Israeli Authority. And they have a sign there that says, welcome to Kafka's world. Because the
so
the,
surreal.
So surreal. Mm-hmm. That it's like you live in Kafka's novel, The Trial, right? Someone who is put on trial and he never knows what he's charged with. He never knows where he's supposed to. It's sort of a picture of bureaucracy gone awry. And this is something that a lot of Palestinians refer to in relationship to the occupation, and in terms of particularly the civil administration, which runs the West Bank. So that was something that I really thought of. You know, this is a film that's called The Trial that Aissa made. So it's referencing that, referencing the absurdity of not only sort of the occupation, but also to some degree the absurdity of the utopian aspirations of revolution that have tried and failed to overthrow the occupation. So in some ways, what it looks at is the absurdity of the overall condition from multiple perspectives. But in my view, it also is looking for like a third perspective that's not trapped in that absurdity, but potentially can see it from the outside. So those were my first thoughts.
Do you think, Aissa, that all the efforts that have ever existed to build a utopia, are they all basically doomed to failure? I mean, is this a human impossibility that we can't quite let go of wishing for?
No, because when Israel was established after 1948, it was part of the Zionist utopia. The difference, it became a colonialist project. But for some people who came to Palestine from different parts of the world in the beginning of 19th century, some of those pioneers or settlers, they were socialists. They believed they're coming to the Holy Land and to establish this socialist heaven where they can solve all the problems and build a safe haven for the Jews, and then ended up to become a colonialist project. So many utopians, they never been realized, and many utopians end up to become a disaster. So it's depends which, how do you look at utopia, from which position, and which kind of ideological utopia, you know. The Soviet Union was an utopia, became a disaster. Eastern Europe was an utopia, became a disaster. Saddam Hussein was an utopia. You know, he came with Arab modernism to build this Arabic socialism. And then Iraq became the worst place to live in the world. Hafez al-Assad became after, as an answer to Arab modernism. And Syria today is a disaster. So utopia is it's very complex and a very problematic term. But in the same time, I'm looking at utopia from a very naive perspective, and I'm looking for those stories that are so romantic, you know, because there's one side for utopia that was a disaster historically, you know, and you know every nation can declare itself as an utopian project, but in the history of Israel Palestine, these small utopian project that was criminalized was so naive, you know. I spoke to Udi. Udi's still alive, you know. I told him, would you do it again? He said, no. I told him, why? He said, I was naive and young. Today, it sounds like a joke, you know? And secondly, to think about him, he was a pilot in the Israeli army, to go and train how to use a Kalashnikov with Palestinians in Syria, it sounded like a joke. And I told him, why did you do it? You know, you could have trained everybody. He said, because I wanted to show solidarity, right? And I think what was relevant to the 1970s in that context, at that time, people in the Third World believed that socialism was possible because they were looking at the Eastern European bloc as a successful project and then end up to be a disaster. But at that time, people were fantasizing. You know, I know I have lots of friends from Israel who are Palestinians and Jews who were part of the historical Israeli-Palestinian communist movement. Some of them, they still believe that socialism is possible in Haifa, and tomorrow we can build this socialist heaven and save everybody, you know? It's a position, you know? I think this is why, for me, I'm really interested in the impossible of the impossible. You know, my reference point is Kafka because it's a... You know, Kafka's trial is impossible to realize. You know, I watched the movie many times, I read the book, and every time I did it, it was a painful experience because Kafka is not easy to read, is not easy to follow the films that they made after Kafka. But I thought because of the reality is so complicated and because this small narrative, you know, come out of the history of Palestine, Israel, it's the impossible of the impossible, so maybe it will be really interesting to turn it into artwork because... And then as an artist, I can do whatever I want with it. I don't have to be faithful to the history because I'm not a historian. So I created this two-channel video performance piece with the professional actors. With me, it was like the less professional actor to come every time to interfere with the work and give them water and give them coffee and wear this blue T-shirt. I took the position of the artist as a working class. You know, this is the same position that the left took in the 1970s. And I was very careful all the time to produce this piece and make sure that aesthetically is in the same way that I really wanted to be and to avoid any sarcasm about it. Because you watch it and you stand there and you try 15 minutes to understand what they're really trying to talk about. It's impossible to get it. And the way that the video been established or constructed is a 3 minutes of five chapters. And every time these two guys come and sit on the table and try to speak, say something. Okay, and then they start really interfering with each other. And then another actor comes and I go and they put water, take coffee and they move. And they spin around these two cameras. It's almost like there is no way you're going to get anything out of this video. You know, maybe you take a few sentences from here and there, but it's not made to give you the full speech. You know, the full speech is like a huge full newspaper page. Will take hours to read it in front of the camera. So I wanted to create a video piece that is exactly the impossible of the impossible of the impossible of the impossible.
We're speaking with artist Aissa Dibi about his film, The Trial, featured in the SMU show, Where Are You From? The curator of that show, Noah Simblist, is with us as well. We'll return in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with artist Aissa Dibi, whose film The Trial is prominently featured in an exhibition at the Pollock Gallery on the SMU campus through September 26th. The exhibition is called Where Are You From? Its curator is with us as well. Noah Simblist is associate professor and chair of the Division of Art at the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or you can email think@kera.org. There are, Noah, also some still works in the show, and there are other video or film works. How are they on display? It's not simultaneous that all the videos are playing.
They are, actually.
Are they?
Yeah, and we had to work really hard to try to find a way to make them all work together. And this is the difference between sort of a film screening and an art installation. So the Pollock Gallery, we divided it into three sections, essentially. So there's one space where there's a projection of Kamala Jaffery's film, The Roof. But we have the sound being piped in through a sound dome, which directs it directly under to to the viewer without bleeding too much to the other videos. Aissa's piece is kept within its own room on monitors so that you can sit at a bench. He had asked that viewers sit at the bench and that the monitors be at the eye height for people who are seated, almost as if you're sitting at the trial and listening directly. And then there's a work by Dorgez, which is also projected, again, with a sound dome sort of in another spot, so at a different sight line. And then there are seven out of a series of 12 photographs, prints, that are connected to that piece. And then there's one monitor with an earlier piece of his called Watermelons Under the Bed. And what I was hoping ideally is that you can kind of see at certain points in the gallery all of them working together. In some ways you can kind of, especially because I assumed that most viewers actually are not, don't speak Arabic or Hebrew, which are the primary languages that the videos are in, that even if you are just looking from afar, reading the subtitles or even seeing the imagery, that there's a kind of... there's an aesthetic relationship that one can have to these works, be it the landscape of Israel-Palestine, be it the aesthetics of a courtroom or sort of the abstraction of a courtroom as a theater, you know, even to equate potentially the landscape of Israel-Palestine as a theater or as a courtroom. Those kind of echoes could occur without having to go too deeply into the specifics of like one place or one particular family story.
You've written about this, Noah, the fact that typically when artists are identified on a placard in a museum or in a gallery, one of the only pieces of information that you get about them is their nationality,
right?
Where are they from? And that's presumed to be so important and such a signifier of who we are, what we believe in, that that's one of like three or four things,
sure,
with name and date of birth that we learn about an artist. And I wonder how both of you feel about the appropriateness of this, especially given the subject matter that you're dealing with here.
I think for me, you know, I think that it makes sense for one to want to get a kind of orientation in terms of, you know, just like the question of the show, where are you from? You know, everyone wants to get an orientation of, okay, well, who is this person in relationship to their origin? But the difficulty in that question is for me, the problematic in that question is the assumption that it's an easy answer, that it's just one proper name.
Okay, now I've got you. Right. Yeah.
Right. Now I understand. You're Palestinian. Oh, now I understand. You're American. You know, and traveling outside of this country, a lot of Americans also, I'm sure, have encountered the problematics of people assuming something about you. I think for me, it's, you know, what could be interesting is to think through nationality as a story in itself, a story that sort of unfolds with multiple dimensions. I think that, you know, the artists in this show really are very much connected to this. I mean, Kamal Al-Jafri lives in Berlin. Even though the show to some extent is framing his work in relationship to the question of Israel-Palestine, and the work being shown is, he also has this connection to a whole European community. Dorgez is an artist who's shown also very much in Europe and Latin America. And even though he could be related to being Palestinian or being Israeli, half of his family is also connected. They're Jews whose origin were in North Africa. So he's, an Arab Jew and an Arab Palestinian, but also potentially none of them. There's a group of artists in Tel Aviv that I was very interested in for a while that have this project called Ex-Territory Project, where they have a series of boats where they hold conferences and exhibitions in the Mediterranean Sea in international waters. So they would bring together people from Iran and Israel and Palestinians and people from basically a series of nations that they couldn't travel back and forth to themselves. Iran and Israel at war, it's impossible to get on a plane from one to the other.
Yeah.
Or the same thing from Beirut to Tel Aviv, even though they're so close. What they're trying to do, which again is somewhat utopian, is to find this sort of external space, you know, a space in between nationality.
It's interesting even to think about, you know, you're having to take a literally a physical risk to engage in this experience.
Yeah, yeah. And I think to some degree, I know Aisa and I talked a lot about this, that terminology itself, like you say on a wall label, terminology, even in an interview like this, can be somewhat dangerous for some artists, you know, mm-hmm. so like in terms of where they might be traveling or working or one issue that is very much connected to any kind of intellectual or cultural activities in relationship to Israel-Palestine is the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which there are many different camps within what's called BDS for short, there are a number of people who ascribe to this, not just Palestinians or Palestinian solidarity activists, who will refuse to work with an exhibition or an institution that is funded by the Israeli government. But there are some people who decide to even not show with someone who might be in an exhibition who is an Israeli artist. For instance, I was just in São Paulo in Brazil, and the biennial there had a big problem because the biennial had received some money from the Israeli government, and a number of the artists participating had signed, almost 70 out of 80 of the artists signed something saying that if they didn't return the money, they wouldn't participate in the exhibition. So the questions of how we name people sometimes actually is a real risk, both, you know, financial, in terms of social capital, and then sometimes it could be risks that are quite greater.
Yeah, I want to say something from a personal narratives. When I was a student in England, one night I was going back home from my studio, and then on the way in Manchester in England, there's a pub called First In, Last Out, and there's a guy standing outside totally drunk, and he looked at me and said, "Go back to your country, Jamaica," you know? And I was very, very happy the first time somebody telling me I'm from somewhere really interesting. I said, "I'm really happy to go back to Jamaica if you pay my ticket." You know? And for me, you know, anybody will be offended. You know, for me, this is like really a joke. You know, it's like, oh, I'm from Jamaica. Now people start to think probably I'm from somewhere else. I think the challenge for every Palestinian artist historically is that you're born into a situation where everything you do, it's ideological. It's considered ideological. So when you produce artwork, it has to be, the motivation for artwork has to be activism. If you make a painting, it has to be activism. If you produce a video, it has, so everything was, we were framed into this ideological frame where culture was looked at only from a political, from a political position. And also the Palestinian culture itself, for many years, was hegemonized by the politics. So you produce work because you live in this particular environment, but also politicians, they made aesthetical decisions how Palestinian art should look like and how Palestinian culture should look like. And in many events, Darwish, the national poet of Palestine, he said, "I never wanted to be the national poet of Palestine. I wanted to write about love and about nature and about myself. But I became the national poet of Palestine, and this is a huge responsibility. To be somebody who really wants to have this freedom to create art and then deal with Palestine as a subject matter was quite a challenge for all Palestinians who were engaged in creative production. So I think where you come from for many years was almost a complex position, you know, and was even an easy way for the other to judge your work without really understanding what you're trying to produce. I remember many, many years ago, when I went to the first gallerist in New York to show my work, I used to make a constructive photography, and they used military toys to create those situations based on historical war photography. And the gallerist looked at the photograph, and she asked me, like, the dumbest question I ever had in my life. "So this is an Israeli soldier, and this is a Palestinian kid." I folded my portfolio, and I left. And for me, this was, if you read my work this way, I'm not really interested, because I'm an artist. And it happened, I was born in this place of the world, and this place been having political problems since the days of Jesus. It's not like only the 20th century, you know? So
whether that's encouraging or not, I can't really say.
No, it's not. But just, I think it's time that Palestinian art have an exposure of real interest in Palestinian culture, rather just interest in Palestinian politics. Yeah. Because there's really very good Palestinian artists, and they never had the opportunity because everything that's looked at is from a political perspective. And also it's time for Palestinian artists to be liberated politically from the political hegemony to produce work. Because if you want to produce work about your personal autobiography, it's part of the story of Palestine. It's not like everything you produce as a Palestinian is not connected. I think we need this freedom to be able to produce work outside of this geographical context, because being a Palestinian artist, living in New York, teaching in New York, being an American citizen, my Palestinian geography expanded all the way to Astoria. So Palestine is no longer only a small geographical entity. It's an expansion. It's a personal experiences. And I think where are you from remains a question, but it's very easy to answer, you know. Then what you do with it, that's the question. That's the challenge, you know.
As a curator, Noah, you also have to think about where the audience is coming from, yeah, and how much they'll understand walking in. And can you talk a little bit about the amount of context you wanted to provide and what you chose not to provide to maybe, I don't know, maybe you want people to go and do some research on their own after they've engaged with the art?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that I constantly struggle with. Every piece of writing that I've ever done on the issue could have, you know, so many sub footnotes, like even, you know, the date 1948 and what that represents, or the date 1967 and what that represents. Or
there's 500 pages right there.
So many just in each. And then all these different, you know, scholars and political scientists arguing over the meanings of these dates. So I chose not to within the exhibition itself. Like, so there's no wall text that really says that much about the particularities of the political situation. But what I have been doing is a couple things. So one is that I've been doing walkthroughs. Like, so for instance, on Saturday we did a gallery talk where I gave an overview of the exhibition, and Issa gave a little bit of a overview of his work. And then I've been doing visits with classes to talk specifically about the exhibition. And I think that helps a little bit just to give the opportunity for going deeper into the political culture, but also the aesthetic culture that Issa is talking about. So one thing is that not only how do these artists network, you know, how does their work network out into a larger political situation, but how does it network out into a series of different artists and curators and critics that are working in relationship to this subject matter? So I did set up a little research area that has a series of books that give, they're mostly Palestinian or Israeli writers, but some are art historians like Ariella Azoulay, who has written a lot about photography in relationship to the politics of this region, but also Rashid Khalidi, who's written about Palestinian identity. He's a historian based in Columbia University. So, and hopefully what those would give is also a kind of bibliography to each of those books that can go even deeper.
The exhibition, Where Are You From?, is on display at the Pollock Gallery on the SMU campus through September 26th. We've been speaking this hour with curator Noah Symblist, also associate professor and chair of the Division of Art at the Meadows School of Arts at SMU, and artist Aisa Deeby, whose 2013 film The Trial is featured in the show. Guys, it's been great to have both of you here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Connect. We had Alan Roberts today engineering the show, and we had help on the phones from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.